Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Phaedra Pazzullo. I'm a faculty member at the University of Colorado Boulder in the United States.
Thank you so much for being with us. You have a very interesting brick building in your background out your window, I think, or is that a picture?
It is actually where I am. Boulder is a breathtaking place, and I wish we weren't on this side of the building because we just had this 10-minute rainstorm. But where I live is gracious enough that whenever that happens, we get gorgeous rainbows. So we have beautiful rainbows across the mountains right now. And you can't see, but the building next to it has Black Lives Matter in all the windows. So it is an active place on campus, but we don't get the rainbow view.
And Boulder is indeed a fabulous, fabulous town. Really, really wonderful. Colorado is, in terms of your department, but also in terms of what it's like as a place, a really important site for doing much of the work that you do, which is environmental communication, I think.
It is. I grew up in a city, Philadelphia in the United States, where I used to joke if you were in a coffee shop, you'd trip over a nurse or a doctor. And here, if you're in a coffee shop, you, because there's so many hospitals there. But here, if you trip over someone at a coffee shop, it's likely to be a climate scientist. We just have so many climate scientists here. I've never been someplace. And when scientists like Jane Goodall come to town, they're treated as if they're, you know, Beyonce, mega Taylor Swift celebrities, because we have so many science nerds that we just flock to events like that. So it's a particular place.
Wow. And Prof, I wanted to get things going really by asking you, if you would, to share with us what are the things that are currently preoccupying, fascinating, troubling, preoccupying you? What are the things that are going on for you right now?
That's a lovely open-ended question that's hard to answer because, like you, I'm interested in so many social justice and climate justice issues, and there's a lot going on right now in the world. But I will narrow it down to the theme of our conversation, I hope, today, which is I'm headed to the Caribbean for the first time next week. For me, I'm headed to the Dominican Republic because the government is working with engineers and other scholars to try to figure out how to address plastics in the Caribbean. And they have invited me to join them. So my Spanish is definitely not as good as yours, but I have been brushing up and trying to learn a little bit more about what it means to be in these island nations that many of my students and colleagues have published about for years. And think about these petrochemical products that are destroying the shoreways and the way of life there.
That's exciting, although, of course, tragic. And it relates to, I imagine, a wonderful book that you wrote, came out just a couple of years ago, less than 2 years ago it would be, I think, Beyond Straw Men, where you write very evocatively about the issues to do with plastics and toxicity around the globe and issues of gender and questions of global South and North relationships. And you also write very evocatively about the personal issues that you and so many of us went through during the period of writing that book. And there's a very moving moment when you talk about, in a sense, suspending your disbelief or self-criticism over the use of plastics at times at the limit of survival and death when it came to the use of medical plastics and so on. And I wondered if you would mind talking to us a bit about the book, perhaps also this question, which comes up again and again, of the responsibility or otherwise of individuals as consumers, as users of plastics, how relevant that is next to the military, corporations, governments.
Right. I mean, the answer is in the question, which you know too well. I loved actually Your book, A COVID Charter, A Better World. And I realized in preparing for this podcast that in cutting my word count, the direct reference to that project was left on the editing floor. But I think your critique of untrammeled capitalism and under-resourced governments in ongoing neoliberalism, it was really key to this moment. So this fall, my latest book, Beyond Straw Men, came out, and it has two intertwined threads. One is it's an environmental story, I would say, about single-use plastics, and why campaigns, advocacy campaigns online and offline from 2016 to 2020 in the US, Kenya, Vietnam, and other locations mattered. And that thread covers issues you've written about, like greenwashing, as well as ecological impacts and frontline impacts of that particular product. But the other part is part of why I'm very excited to talk with you today, because I'm trying to think about plastics at this time in the United States as what a classic cultural studies text that you know well, Policing the Crisis, called an articulator of crisis. And so when do we get these charged objects or issues in a culture that suddenly become the way that so many different what people in the United States call culture wars or other issues get worked out? So I am trying to grapple with what I consider to be structural issues. I guess a better answer to your question is I'm definitely trying to embrace impure politics, and we could talk more about that because I find too many times on environmental issues, people think it's only up to the individual, and if they're not perfect, why bother at all? And of course, that's very unsatisfying politically.
Well, that means one has to ask, what's impure politics?
Yes, I would be intrigued, of course, with your answer to all the questions that come up today. But for me, impure politics is actually a term that I started to embrace in the 90s when I was studying with Larry Grossberg in the United States, a cultural studies scholar who was trying to think about why was the right, the conservatives in the United States at the time, why were they seeming to be so much more popular than the left? And how was the left getting caught up in tiny details and sometimes cannibalizing itself? And political history often repeats itself. But I found that particular analysis interesting because even today, I'll joke with people that, conservatives don't mind if we fact check and find out they're lying, or if we find out there's an inconsistency. A lot of journalism in the United States is about that. Like, let's count how many lies this president said or this corporation did. It doesn't actually move the people who are doing the lying or who are inconsistent. But progressives, we could spend months working on a vision statement or a mission statement and debating each other about like tiny words that matter, of course, but don't always create as capacious of a tent. So impure politics is a term to embrace the fact that none of us are perfect, that all of us, for example, you brought up, use plastics. And so nobody can go an hour in, the global north without touching a plastic. There are plastics on the computer I'm talking with you about. There are plastics, even though I'm using a metal coffee mug right now, there's plastic on the lid of it. The table I'm sitting at, the chair I'm sitting at, the rug, the walls all have plastic in them. And so it can seem, whether it's plastics or capitalism or technology industries, like, what's the point of resisting if they're so ubiquitous? And of course, that is part of how the global elites have convinced us not to care and not to invest in resistance.
There's a wonderful moment in The Graduate, which I imagine you may have used in teaching or in seminars about this book, where the idea of the height of boredom because of banality is revealed to be working in plastics, right? One is struck dumb by that conversational gambit, plastics. And it is that ubiquity that I think is so overwhelming. And yet, Books like yours and campaigns by many social movements have drawn serious attention to these things. We do have governments in different places, making it more difficult to use plastic bags at checkouts. We get plastic bags being charged for, which was once not the case, and people thinking about some of these questions, at least thinking about them. But I guess there is a tendency for this to be at the level of individual consumption rather than corporate decision making.
Well, that's part of what I was grappling with in the United States, and perhaps you could tell me if this is true in Europe and Australia and other places. The plastics issue, when it came up as a major controversy in 2016, came up as an individual consumption issue. And part of what was happening is people were having knockdown, drag out fights about plastic straws, of all things, and publicly shaming disabled people at diners and online, about their use of single-use plastics and straws. And this, like so many of my research projects, this one comes out of me not understanding why is culture heading this way? Why is this becoming, of all the environmental and climate justice topics I'm interested in, why was that the one to gain the traction? And you find that, of course, there is decades-long campaigns by the industry to make us believe that plastic recycling is an individual issue. But what we need is structural change. It's just that advocates, as you know, often want to start somewhere. So single-use plastics become the gateway plastic, as I call it, to have people find something relatable in their everyday lives. To talk about the larger issues of, for example, petrochemicals, which I have written about for a long time. And I know you've had people on this podcast talk about the petrochemical industry in the US and elsewhere. So it's an entry point, but certainly not satisfying to blame individuals, correct?
I think it's almost 20 years now since BP got public relations advice, long before, but in fact, of course, during its assault on the Gulf and other places, to circulate the desirability of one establishing one's own carbon footprint. It was BP's invention, but generated by public relations firms. And it seems to me that's been immensely effective in this individuation of responsibility, although there were other things related to it beforehand. Keep America Beautiful was very much about don't litter.
Exactly.
What's the prettiest town in America and so on from my childhood. But I guess also related to that, Prof P, would be the desire on the part of smart non-government organizations, third sector activists, to pick up on something, and I think it relates to your concept of impure politics, where at least they can get some traction, some interest. They can get consumerist neoliberal ideologies to pay attention. So it's one of these areas, perhaps, it's just speculation, where there's a trajectory one could draw between, first of all, keep America beautiful, don't throw tissues out of the car, to BP and PR campaigns and the carbon footprint calculator onto NGOs deciding this is an issue that they can work with.
Yes, exactly. So you just mapped beautifully the greenwashing history of this campaign, where what I call the plastic industrial complex convinces people in the US, has what we call public service announcements telling us, keep America beautiful, telling us, and it's an individual problem, telling us it's a litter problem. So the global plastics treaty that's being negotiated right now, we still have corporations globally that are trying to say, yes, let's address plastics, but only address it at the stage of litter, and not that the production of plastics is a problem. And in the United States, a lot of people, because we're like immersed in this neoliberal capitalist culture do attach themselves to, oh, we should care about plastics because of the viral video about a turtle, and we should care about plastics because it's something I can do in my everyday life. And lo and behold, I can buy a reusable bottle, which of course fits with neoliberalism as a way to imagine ecological solutions. We just have to buy the right stuff. And yes, NGOs are trying desperately to link that impulse with one that asks for structural change and asks for rethinking, can we increase government regulations for petrochemical industries to protect public health? Can we consume less? Can we repair and care? And all of those things become interrelated. So, is it an opportunity or is it a distraction? Is a lot of what I talked about with different activists, right? Does it become the gateway to get people to go, you know, in the old days we would call it consciousness raising, to go from an everyday relatable ex idea to something more structural? Or does it become this distraction and someone says, oh, I, you know, used a reusable bag at the grocery store today, so I don't have to worry about the protest against BP or Shell?
At the same time, of course, if, for example, one's thinking about diapers, people can undergo a serious debate for themselves about
Yes.
plastic diapers, which you mention in the book, versus the environmental impact of washing diapers and all the
Yes.
soap suds and all the water that gets used, right? I mean, you can have a debate about these things.
Yes.
I mean, it can be quite complex where people don't want to be perfect and they don't think it's all about consumption. But they do want to discourage the corporate world from constantly engaging in and vending practices on a limited band of choice that are ecologically destructive.
Yes, that's a wonderful way to put it, a limited band of choice. That is part of what on my campus, I've been working with people for 3 years now, and we're hoping we're about to sign a new contract for our vending machines on campus to replace the single-use plastic bottles. But the much harder issue to get people to talk about is what is the climate impact of the vending machine itself? What does it mean to have small refrigerators all over our campus that have to run 24/7? Those sometimes are more challenging for people to think about because, as so many have said, we have to change every facet of life in this you know, speed. But part of that's why part of plastics became so popular, right? The fossil fuel industry is seeing a reduced demand due to success of shifting from a fossil fuel-based economy to a renewable economy, and they want to make up for that with plastics. So we've seen an astronomical increase in the use of plastics from, you know, The Graduate as a film in the mid 20th century all the way till today. And so some people, if you talk to elders, will say, well, of course we would reuse wax paper or aluminum foil to wrap a sandwich. And why would you throw it away right away? Because it costs money and we valued it. It was an object. And what they've been so successful at is they have convinced us of the seduction of convenience and disposability, because they knew their profit line would go up if we would start to imagine more objects, and I would argue more people as disposable. And as soon as you think more humans and more objects are disposable, then, you know, you have a lot less barriers to the elites gaining more and more wealth in the world.
I'm thinking here of Alec Guinness in Man in the White Suit, an inventor who works for a company and discovers a formula for a suit that will make it basically perfect forever. It'll never get dirty, it'll never tear, it'll never go out of fashion, and so on. And is initially acclaimed by workers, management, and government, and then run out of town when the implications are understood in terms of the labor process, capitalism and public welfare in inverted commas. So, which is actually something I need to watch again, I realize, because my little adumbration of it could be hopeless, but I think it's roughly right. In any
Yeah.
event, I do think that's an extraordinary insight, and it's wonderful that you're doing that work on campus. Absolutely terrific, because universities are gigantic economic and social and cultural entities. Wherever they may be found. And Prof, I wondered if I could also ask you about New Orleans, because you've mentioned the Gulf as have I, and you've written at least three articles that I've read about New Orleans. They go back a while, the ones that I'm familiar with. The work that you did there, and maybe explain a little bit about New Orleans to listeners outside the United States who may know about the Gulf crisis from a decade and more ago, and may know about it in terms of its cultural heritage and contemporaneity, but perhaps not much more.
So that is a decades-long interest of mine, and gets back to this theme of I end up writing about things that confuse me or are moments of stuttering with others. So when I was in graduate school in the 90s, and I was working with communities facing extreme environmental pollution, I would go on these things called toxic tours. People would fly me in to do what they do with politicians after a disaster or journalists during a war, and communities take you around block by block and give witness and testimony to the impacts of whatever the problem was. And in my case, the problem was pollution. And other students would say, "Oh, what are you doing this weekend? You know, we're going to a concert or a show." And I'd be like, "Oh, I'm going on a toxic tour." And they would be like, "What? What is that?" And so I realized there must be something there. And one of the communities I initially wrote about was Southern Louisiana. And it was really hard for me to get my first book published, which came out of my dissertation research. And I have publishers who said to me, "Well, who cares about Southern Louisiana? I've never heard of this place." And as my first monograph goes out, Hurricane Katrina hits. So part of why Hurricane Katrina is so devastating in US history is that New Orleans is this amazing city that is a mix of so many different cultures, African American, indigenous, Spanish, French, Italian, and when they knew this storm was coming, that was gaining speed because the petrochemical industry had destroyed all the mangroves in the area, the trees in the area that would have slowed down the hurricane. The hurricane picks up speed because, as we know, the planet is warming. So there's all, it became literally the perfect storm of climate change. The US military calls climate change a threat multiplier in their language. And that's what happened in New Orleans. And what happened in New Orleans is a lot of residents did not want to leave. They did not have faith in their government. They did not know the extent that the storm would be problematic. And it took days for then the US President Bush Jr. To land. So in the United States, we had had 9/11, which many people globally know about, unfortunately, because of the US military. And the president immediately landed on the ground and stood next to firefighters and first responders and showed American pride and told everyone to go shopping, as the US often does. But in New Orleans, he flew over and did not stand on the ground with the people, or did not stand on the roofs where many people had been flooded. So I had to add an afterword to my book where I was like, "Oh, this community I was writing about in the first chapter that nobody knew about was the Ninth Ward in Louisiana, and now suddenly a lot of people were talking about it everywhere." There are many residents there. I know you've had people on this program, including one of my favorite scholars, David Pellow. And I use a term in my latest book that David Pellow coined. That talks about the global South and the global South of the North. And New Orleans, Southern Louisiana, the Gulf Coast in the United States really epitomizes the global South of the North. So all terms are problematic when we try to clump the heterogeneity of the world into two spheres, but certainly less problematic than most developed to least developed or first world to third world. I lean into David Pellow's language of the global South and the global South and the North because in those communities, plastics become a life or death issue. whether it is Bangladesh, which is the first country in the world to have a plastic bag ban because people are literally dying, they're drowning to death due to the extreme climate storms that are happening, and the bags were clogging up the drainage system, to southern Louisiana, where people are dying, they have a higher cancer rate because that's where the petrochemicals are being produced. And so I think it's really important because in the United States, we do sometimes, due to vested interests, they portray environmentalists as, and this happens, I know, in Britain too, and did with plastics, by some journalists. They refer to environmental issues as elite white issues. But as you know from your research in the global South, and the global South of the North, they're not elite issues. They're literally bread and butter. They're literally life or death issues. And that's what interests me.
And I should say that your toxic tourism book from Alabama is a terrific volume. And I should also mention that the one that's recently come out is from California, two very distinguished presses. And for sure, I think your account of what occurred in terms of presidential image politics is absolutely spot on and all too tragic. And I guess one thing I'd quickly add is that New Orleans is still two-thirds African American, so it's unusual in its population outlook, its demographics, and that means, of course, that it is subject to environmental injustice, as are all minority and working class areas in the United States. And that brings me on to another topic where you've published very fulsomely and importantly, as has Professor Pello, and that is environmental justice and the need for some transformation, not just within our world, as it were, but specifically to environmental movements. And I wondered if you could perhaps chat with us a wee bit about that, Prof.
Yeah, that's a big topic. So that goes back to the early 90s for me, where my interest in social justice and environmental quality, sustainability come together. And this language of environmental racism is coined in the United States. So environmental racism is an articulation in the United States of the civil rights movement, which is the right predominantly for African Americans to have equal rights in the United States, with the environmental movement, which was more associated prior to that time with areas for recreation and play, like national parks, and not everyday life. And the mid-20th century sort of started bringing that movement more together in ways that there were conflicts before, and we can go into that. But what happened to me is in the early 90s, I moved to North Carolina, a state in the United States, and the place that is known as the birthplace of the environmental justice movement is there. And I hitched a ride with some performance studies scholars in a van who were heading out to rural North Carolina because I was like, I just have to see this place. This is the birthplace of the movement that I think is so important. And I got there, and the landfill was still there. The landfill is was polychlorinated biphenyls. There, it just people should know it's a toxic chemical that's a byproduct of other chemical processes. And the community that in the 90s was being celebrated, emerging in this new literature called environmental justice studies as the birthplace of the movement, still had the landfill. And the landfill was still causing health issues for the community. So this struck me as incredibly problematic that we would be celebrating a place that actually hadn't had justice itself. So I spent time going there in the 90s because they had coined this term in 1982, environmental racism, and helped them lobby the government. We got $2.1 million, which at the time was a really big deal, to clean up the landfill finally. That was placed in this community. And the community was chosen. It had to violate two environmental standards of the soil, the thickness of the soil, and where the water table was. in order to place it in the community that was predominantly black and also poor. And so, yes, environmental racism is a key term in my work. I think for so many of us, it helped transform defining the environment not just as someplace out there, but reminding people as indigenous cultures and so many other non-Western cultures long had believed that the environment is us. We're part of the environment. Humans aren't only in conflict with the environment, we're part of it. And where we live, where we work, and where we play are also part of the environment. So that more robust understanding of environmental issues is where my research lies.
And there is a rhetoric, right or wrong. And there are some data now to show that this has changed, to the effect that environmental activists tend to be in the United States and in much of Western Europe, white and middle class, and tend not to include the principal victims and survivors of environmental injustice or their forms of knowledge. Is that an issue? Is it lessening as a question, as a problem?
Yes, that is an issue, and it also is an issue that the petrochemical industry attempts to exploit, and I feel like has become better with specific coalitions and alliances. Not all. There's, as you know, lots of environmental NGOs that are still pay their directors large sums of money, and those directors still skew towards white cis males. But we have more that are more inclusive now. And there certainly has become an acknowledgement in more environmental histories I read, among more environmentalists I know, not just to have romanticized views of like the stereotypical and offensive noble savage indigenous person who can do no wrong, but often was evoked by environmentalists. And in the famous public service announcement of the crying Indian ad, it was an Italian American playing a Native American that's crying. There's lots to unpack in that symbol that the industry likes to promote. But there are community groups like in Southern Louisiana that have worked for a very long time in alliance with anyone who's willing to support them, with anyone who's willing to amplify their voices and let them lead and makes and let them lead in the sense of white supremacy so often assumes what experts look like or sound like, are, white cis males. And so I do find hope. I think it's a lot better. Now it's hard to meet an environmentalist under the age of 30, certainly, who doesn't know the term environmental racism or environmental justice, who doesn't talk about climate justice when it comes to the COPs internationally in global treaties, where at the Global Plastics Treaty this week, there are waste pickers who gave testimony and indigenous communities that are frontline or fence line communities that gave testimony. And so we might not be the dominant voice still, but I think certainly there's enough that no longer if I tell people what I, what type of protest I'm going to, if I say climate justice, are they scratching their head? They might not agree with me, but they at least understand why there would be an alliance between communities of people of color and communities that exceed that, who work for worker rights, labor rights, or environmental protections.
Perhaps a more recent term than climate justice is climate colonialism. I wonder if you could maybe explain that concept for us and whether you subscribe to it.
Yes, definitely. I think it's an important term. I've always argued that there is no colonial struggle that's not an environmental struggle. All colonial struggles are over resources, access to resources, access to water, spices, access to land, land sovereignty. All of those are ecological issues. So the idea that there was a small group of people who helped create an imaginary that the environment was just places to play. Is not the majority of the world. The majority of the world has long understood that land rights and water rights are key to any decolonial or anti-colonial or post-colonial struggle. So in my own work, part of where we you and I are in dialogue with Pello's work on the Global South, I also draw upon Max Lebrun, who's the other person who blurbed at the back of my book, who wrote a book on pollution colonialism, an indigenous scientist who talks about plastic pollution and how indigenous cultures are being colonized by microplastics in the fish that they eat, in their own bodies, in their breast milk, in their blood, in their lungs, as we all are. From petrochemical industries. And so there is a microscopic level of pollution as colonialism, as well as a geopolitical level that is negotiated in these international treaties, where the communities that are being hit first and worst often, usually, are communities, we call this the cruel irony of climate change, that have contributed the least to global greenhouse gases. And so the communities that are creating the most, the countries that are creating the most greenhouse gases are those that also fall along the lines of colonial powers in the world. So David Pello also talks about waste imperialism, which I think is related, but pollution colonialism, I think, is gaining more traction, and I think that's really important.
There's also this anxiety on the part of some that environmental movements can see the at least understood interests of First Peoples and sometimes Afro-descended peoples against the environment. And the argument that you bastards all had development, why shouldn't we? And so on. I mean, arguments about, for example, the new rush in northern Sweden to mine materials that ironically are in the same place as the iron ore that made the country wealthy in the 19th century, that now are providing rare earth minerals. And there are splits within the Sami community over we want development, we want money, we want investment, and we want our lands left pristine and we want control. Something you can see in a television series like Thin Ice about Greenland. And so I wonder about that, that this is both a description, as you say, of the ecological heart of colonial involvements, but also a critique of environmentalism.
Indigenous communities that live on what they would call Turtle Island, but the unceded lands of North America, have at the last COP talked about what they call false solutions, right? And so false solutions are, for example, carbon credits, where very rich companies claim they're going to get to carbon neutral operations. And what they're doing is they're paying other communities not to pollute, but they're still polluting. And lots of indigenous communities have pointed out that this creates uneven power relations. It institutionalizes these uneven ways of relating to the environment and ways of relating to ecological limits. And certainly, better than I in South America, the debt for nature swaps, has long been caught up in this controversy, right? Who already has exploited their forests and who is told not to exploit their forests, and what does that mean? So there definitely is a way where indigenous communities can be. That's a lot of the work when I was doing those toxic tours in the 1990s. Those are a lot of the communities and conflicts I was sent to. So, for example, environmentalists and indigenous communities work well together when they all want to protect something like Bears Ears National Park in the United States. But there's conflict when indigenous cultures, as was the case in one example, wanted land back and they wanted to turn a national forest into a casino. And then environmentalists have a harder time saying, oh, we're going to let indigenous people take the lead on what to do with land. And so it's obviously there's so many heterogeneous cultures around the world where there become conflicts of what do we do with resources, who can benefits. That's the classic environmental justice fundamental question that Robert Bullard asked, who, you know, is a sociologist who really helped found the field of environmental justice studies, is who benefits and who pays from technological expansion. It's just that basic political economy question, but truly, if you follow the money a lot of times, it becomes revealing on where one's politics might lie.
Well said, Prof, I may say so. And I wonder if picking up on disciplinary questions, because you've mentioned a couple of different disciplines and theoretical approaches there, pardon me, you could tell us a bit about your own ways of going about engaging these dilemmas. You've already described your participation in social movements and so on, and observation of these events and problems. And it's clear you've made major contributions to environmentalism in general, but specifically to two domains, environmental communication and environmental cultural studies. I wondered if you could share with us a little bit your thoughts about those spheres.
That's a big question. I'm going to give it a shot, and then you can help me tease out maybe in more productive ways. I did. Thank you for noticing. I did come into graduate school as an activist. I happened when I was 20 to meet the person who at the time was the president of the Sierra Club, who also happened to be professor in communication in a department with Larry Grossberg, who did cultural studies, and Michael Eric Dyson, who's well known at the time and still today in Black studies and Black cultural studies, as well as some performance studies scholars such as Della Pollock and Soyinne Madison. And he asked me to come to graduate school with him, is the short version of the story. And I said, why would I? Communication's the only department I've never taken a class in. In 20, I had lots of answers. And when I was 20, I had the world figured out. I had gotten a BS degree in natural resource sciences, which is an interdisciplinary science degree, because I thought, well, as a woman, if I care about the environment, unless I have a science degree, no one will take me seriously. And after a few semesters of that coursework, I was like, oh, scientists know what's wrong, but they don't know how to do anything with it. And so I did a BA in an interdisciplinary degree called Social Thought and Political Economy, which benefited greatly from what we would call, you know, Black studies, African American studies, as well as this is where I learn about environmental justice as a term, environmental racism as a term, and political economic and social theory. So I meet Robbie when I'm 20, and he's like, you should come study with me. And I'm like, why communication? And he's like, well, do you have a better plan? And of course I did not, because I was 20. And so I went to study with him in this moment at this department, that there were so many interesting people doing such important work. And that brought me to those two areas of study. So one in environmental communication became, how do I grapple with that early observation I had, which is climate scientists, environmental scientists knew what was wrong, but didn't know how to talk to people about it. Didn't know how to relate to people about it. That was supposed to be, science was supposed to be objective in a lab back then, and they weren't supposed to get into the world of podcasts and television shows and all these things they do now, because they were worried they would be seen as not having authority. And in fact, what was happening is because they sealed themselves off, they were losing authority in a media-saturated world, I would argue. And then the other part being cultural studies, which for me, this latest book is actually my an attempt, as I still struggle with, you know, trying to follow in the footsteps of those of you who founded cultural studies, to create a conjunctural analysis, to create a, to me, more satisfying analysis of when we have cultural controversy or conflict about something that's considered a crisis. How do we articulate or imagine something becoming a crisis, Like, why of the over 41 armed conflicts in the world right now is Gaza the one that is captivating the United States at least, as opposed to other issues? Why are our college campuses erupting over that as opposed to climate change? What create those conditions of possibility? And then in trying to figure that out, that that is not inevitable, that that meaning-making process is not pre-given or predetermined, then that gives us the agency to try to intervene, which is, of course, to me, as I know for you, is the point of cultural studies. It should be a political project and not just armchair critiques.
Prof. P, I'd like to ask two more questions, if I may, and then, as a way of concluding, invite you to mention things that we haven't touched on or return to things we have where you'd like to add something. Is that okay as a way of bringing things to a close? Yeah. So, my first question is one that would seem very obvious to many listeners in the US, but may not be to those outside, which is one of the areas where you've made major contributions is in rhetoric. What is it as an academic thing? I mean, I think people understand it at a popular level, but it's a big deal in the United States within the study of communication.
It is. So rhetoric became part of what I studied because that is what this professor Robbie studied. So you study what your mentor studies in part. And at the time, rhetoric was grounded in a story of origin in ancient Greece about the invention of rhetoric happening with the invention of democracy. And that this became a way when people wanted to appeal to something other than divine powers. How would we imagine citizens having a voice, making appeals in courts? And so the study of rhetoric, as such, named as such, is born in the courts, as the story goes, of Greece to allow everyday people to make judgments that weren't just the provenance of kings. And in that sense, it's compelling. Of course, somehow in the United States, Greece gets imagined as a white European nation, which I don't know where you would stand on that conversation. But and part of what I think is good about critiquing any singular story of origin is, of course, there's always multiple origin points. And that is the myth of origins and discourse, of course, as Foucault said. So rhetoric globally, then in other places, is often called discourse studies. And what it is an attempt to study how we communicate and arguably contextual ways, which I think it shares with cultural studies. Rhetoric is always in a particular situation. And how do we move people? So rhetoric is very invested in resistance and social change. And so, in those ways, I think they have similarity. When I was studying rhetoric and cultural studies in the 90s, I started teaching a graduate course soon after my studies on rhetorics of transgression and resistance, because in cultural studies, transgression was more popular at the time, and it was more about how do you read subtle symbols of meaning making. In fashion or in art or in popular culture, that also troubles the norms, troubles the status quo. And that's a very different theory of social change than direct resistance, protest, social movements. And when I was being trained in the two, cultural studies to me, I don't know how you feel about this, was surprisingly to me, slower in the uptake of environmental issues, slower in the desire to critique consumption, because it had invested so much in justifiably creating complex theories to understand consumption and the circulation of consumption, that it didn't necessarily at the time want to deal with. When is it problematic and when does it feed into the status quo? I think that, of course, has changed. And I think part of that change does come from global perspectives of cultural studies, who have wanted to study extractivism and delinking of colonialism for a long time. But in the version I was learning in the United States, there was very few. It was like Andrew Ross, initially, and a lot of his work early on was making fun of environmentalists as white elitists, right? And was not going and finding the frontline communities who cared about environmental issues. So it's changed. It's hard to tell people who didn't live through it how much the field has changed, because it probably sounds unbelievable to some right now. But at the time, it was very hard to get people to talk about the environment. So that's why the two.
And my last question before throwing to you, Prof, is you mentioned your choice of first degree as being in part conditioned by issues of gender. And this is one of the topics, along with many of the other ones that we've focused on a bit more, that runs through your work. I wonder if you could talk about that in two ways. First, within academia, but second, in terms of the environment.
Well, in terms of academia, you know better than I, firsthand accounts of when the feminists came to Birmingham, phrases that were used even by beloved colleagues, and scholars, like Stuart Hall, that the feminists came and shat on the table, I believe was the phrase that people used. That the critique of feminists of the boys' club in so many circles, whether it's rhetoric or cultural studies or anything else, in the United States in particular, this is hard for many people cross-culturally to realize. We live deeply in an ingrained patriarchy. Our presidents have always been men, our congresses are dominated by men. And yes, if you look at who runs the petrochemical industries, it is men. And so sometimes, most of my work places racial capitalism at the forefront. I very much believe that we have to confront, particularly anti-Black racism and also coloniality of indigenous cultures, because the imagining of those communities as disposable is what's led to this unsustainable planet we're living on. And sexism is like the air I breathe. So sometimes I actually forget to put it in my analysis. And I often will get from reviewers, and I did in this book. So I was like, hey, Phaedra, you could say a little bit more about the gender analysis of Fox News and the US President Trump. And I'm like, well, of course I could, and when asked. And so for environmental issues, I draw upon Stacey Limo's work on carbon-heavy masculinity. And obviously there's so many more amazing, brilliant women across the world. I love Julie Doyle's work and Joe Littler's work in Britain. And I also have written work with people in China, like Jingfeng Liu and so many others. And for environmental issues, pollution impacts everyone. Plastic pollution, we all have microplastics in our bodies now. Scientists have shown that. There's none of us who have evaded it. But some of us have more, and some of us become impacted disproportionately when crisis occurs. And that often can land on women's bodies. Which is why in Kenya, Wangari Maathai is such a key figure in, when she was alive, of planting millions of trees in Kenya, trying to link women's empowerment with healing the planet. There's just countless stories around the world. The idea of tree hugger comes from women in India who were literally doing civil disobedience, hugging trees, trying not to have the ruler at the time cut them down. And so even though women have always been involved in environmental struggles because we're on the front lines of environmental struggles, we often aren't imagined as intellectual leaders. We're not often not imagined as political leaders. And so there is something to be said there about one of the many layers in the analysis I try to offer about plastics, about how gender does have a role, and this carbon-heavy masculinity is key to what has made our planet so unsustainable today.
Prof, I wonder now if I could invite you to either to go back over what you've said, because there are things you wish to add, or to delve into other fields as a concluding set of remarks.
Well, first, I want to thank you for the invitation. I remember reading The Well-Tempered Self and Technologies of Truth to go back into the old Miller archives, some of your earlier books when I was in grad school, and reveling in your clever prose, thinking maybe going into higher education wouldn't be the worst plan for my future. I had a very hard time getting into higher education because I did come from an activist background and didn't find a lot of the trappings of academia and its insular nature, compelling. So it's exciting to talk to you, and exciting that your work went into obviously environmental trajectories. And I guess the only thing we didn't talk about from the book that I want to make sure I mention, because so many times when people hear about plastics, one of the ways it articulated a crisis was about eco-ableism. And so I just want to underscore that for the book, I also interviewed multiple disability justice activists. And you brought this up at the beginning of our conversation, that when I was writing the book, my mother was dying, and I was going into hospitals that were replete with plastics and single-use plastics in the name of trying to prolong her life and so many others. And so I definitely am acutely aware that plastics have, whether, if it's an IV tube or for some people, the plastic straw, made their lives more livable. And trying to understand what that means and making space for that dignity and that grace. And one of the conclusions I came to in the process of writing was, to me, every person is necessary, but every plastic is not. And I hope that we find a way to move forward in our politics and in our scholarship where we can continue to theorize and think and enact practices that embrace the dignity of everyone and still create critiques and limits of how we can do better so we have a more sustainable future.
How wonderfully put, Prof. P. I really appreciate it. It's been fantastic having the great privilege to learn from you over many years as a reader of your work and now to chat with you. Thank you very, very much.